always judge folks like us. But I'll have you know, Nat has never gone hungry one goddamn day of her blessed life, and she has always been safe with me. I'd love to see you or any of your fancy friends around here survive one day in my dirty shoes.
I was not born with a silver spoon in my mouth.
Well, I was. Not all mothers protect their children.
Really, Mom? Why do we have to do this right now? Don't ruin everything.
Lila, look. Without a home, the school can't help Nat. And this is a temporary home.
No. Come on, baby. We're fine as long as we're together, okay? Shall we dance?
I'm glad you're leaving.
I'm scared.
Don't be.
Wouldn't you be? Come with.
Sis, that ain't my world. That's why you gotta do it. So I can see you on TV and be like, that's my bitch. So that I don't see you in the subways in 20 years. You just gotta do it so that when you get all famous, I can be your personal assistant.
Oh, please.
Sorry. It's time to say goodbye.
Never. I'll see you later. You got this.
Yeah, she's got this. I don't know if I do.
Welcome to Haven. And which one of you lovely ladies is Lila?
Hello.
Hello, Lila. I'm Terrence. Wonderful to meet you. You must be Nat.
I'm really not sure about all this.
I was once standing right where you are. I know you're scared, but this place will be a fresh start. And I hear from Miss Williams, you two are a hell of a duo.
Yeah, we are.
Let's get you settled.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, got it?
Got it.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye, sweetie. You good?
I woke up to the morning sky first. Baby blue, just like we rehearsed.
We are officially 1 year out from the next presidential election. And guess what? It's time to get to work, guys. From volunteer opportunities to making sure you're registered to vote, Vote Save America has everything you need to help you make the biggest impact in the 2024 election cycle. And guess what? You can start right now in 2023. Head to votesaveamerica.com/no-off-years to find out how you can get involved.
Hey, this is Jeff Lewis from Radio Andy. Live and uncensored, catch me talking with my friends about my latest obsessions, relationship issues, and bodily ailments. With that kind of drama that seems to follow me, you never know what's going to happen.
You can listen to Jeff Lewis live at home or anywhere you are. Download the SiriusXM app for over 425 channels of ad-free music, sports, entertainment, and more. Subscribe now and get 3 months free. Offer details apply.
Welcome to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, good to see you. We're recording this on a Friday.
Friday fun day.
Because it's Thanksgiving week. Yeah. We just recorded something for social where we were talking about all the turkey pardons and the writing of the corniest jokes possible and seeing who could get Barack Obama to say the corniest thing possible at those pardons. Is very fun.
I think I avoided that speech writing task for all 8 years, if I remember.
You just wanted out of that thing?
Yeah, I it was a very particular kind of humor that...
dad joke.
I did not excel at it at the time. Maybe I'd be good at it now that I'm a dad.
You know? I think you would be great at it. I think you sold yourself short.
Thank you, sir.
By backing out of that. So we're recording this Friday, November 17th, because next week is a holiday and Crooked Media will be closed. But we wanted to focus on a big, important issue coming up, which is the COP Climate Change Summit. Where do you rank COPs in your hierarchy of summit faves?
COPs against one another or COPs against other summits? You know,
COPs against other summits.
Okay, so I'm actually going to put COPs at or near the top.
Oh.
And here's why.
Wow.
Because everybody comes to COP, right? So it's not like a G20 or a G7 mm-hmm. or a G8
right,
or NATO. Or even like, you know, now I will say my kind of personal favorite was the East Asia Summit, like the ASEAN East Asia Summit, because it was always in some like cool Southeast Asian country.
Yeah, that's your vibe.
I'd never been to, and it's kind of my vibe, and the food's really good. And you and I also like hung out in like a casino in Phnom Penh where you could like smoke and play slots before crushing a press briefing. But
we were talking about this last week. Yeah, the weirdest 24 hours of my life was going from Aung San Suu Kyi's house to just a smoke-filled, disgusting casino hotel in Cambodia.
I had to walk through the heavily carpeted, disgusting casino to reach the press briefing room where I announced that Hillary Clinton was flying to the Middle East to help broker a ceasefire in Gaza. So that's been on the brain. But the thing about COP is everybody comes, right? So there's like 200 countries there. I mean, you're never in a room with representatives from that many places. And it can be quite chaotic. And you're just kind of wandering around and, oh, there's that world leader. And here's, you know, I've never met the leader of, you know, this island country or, you know. And it could break down. I mean, the Copenhagen COP, right, which is the first one in 2009, we flew there and it had fallen apart. And when I say it had fallen apart, I mean our staff office, including for the President of the United States, was in a mall where there were, like, mannequins
literally
in the office. Mannequins in the office. We're meeting, like, with, like, Dmitry Medvedev amidst some mannequins. The leader's room had been, like, invaded by staff. And so there were like, all these world leaders and just staff, like, roaming and rummaging around and leaders kind of, like, looking over their shoulders. Then that's the one where Barack Obama figured out that the Chinese were holding the whole thing up. And that they were meeting with all the leaders that we wanted to meet. They were meeting with the BRICS leaders at the time, right? So Brazil, India, Russia, China, South Africa. And literally, I got pummeled by Chinese security as Barack Obama, like, stormed into this meeting and yelled, like, are you ready for me when? To win, well, Joe Biden? This is a better time.
You had
this
it coming.
Is, this
you
is
had
a, it coming. A better time in geopolitical relations that was, like, funny, and Wen Jiabao was like, hey, Barack, like, come on in, you know? But meanwhile, I was getting literally pummeled by Chinese secret.
Well, they've been reading your emails. So let me back up a little bit. So the COP summits are the United Nations annual international meetings about climate change. COP stands for Conference of Parties. Fun, exciting name. Because the people meeting are party to the broader UN Treaty on Climate Change. So COP28 kicks off on November 30th. It's in the obvious place for a climate change conference to be the United Arab Emirates. It's in Dubai. President Biden is not expected to attend this year, but he did go to the last two COP meetings in Egypt and Scotland. So, Ben, you know, I think you were getting at the point that, like, historically, these summits can be hit or miss. I think the first one was in Berlin in 95. They basically just agreed to keep meeting.
They agreed to have COPs.
They agreed to have COPs. 97 was led to the Kyoto Protocol, which made certain countries commit to limiting or reducing greenhouse gases. You just mentioned COP15 in Copenhagen. That was a pretty significant one.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about COP15 in Copenhagen is it was seen as this giant failure, because I think what people hoped is that Barack Obama had been elected and the U.S. would come and join the Kyoto Protocol. That wasn't going to happen for a couple reasons. One, the U.S. wasn't going to join an international agreement if China and India and these other major emitters didn't also join it.
Right.
And they were not going to do that. And also, the Kyoto Protocol was a binding treaty that would have required Senate ratification, which also was not going to happen. But as much as it felt like a failure at the time, at Copenhagen, we kind of sketched the outlines of what became the Paris Agreement, which was these kind of shared commitments to emissions reductions, financing for transition and for mitigation for countries dealing with the effects of climate change, and this kind of mechanism to review each year that progress. And so fast forward to Paris, the most successful COP21, the most important COP, you get the Paris Agreement, you get everybody on board, you get the 1.5 degrees Celsius objective, you get every single country in the world making commitments around emissions reductions and around financing. And so we're living in a post-Paris COP world.
And then you mentioned this earlier. I think COP27 led to the creation of something called the Loss and Damage Fund, where rich nations are supposed to help compensate developing nations for the impact of climate change. Actually, pulling together that money is a different story. I think you talk about that with John Kerry later in an interview. But, I mean, what should we make of Joe Biden not going this year? How important or unimportant is it to have the president attending?
I mean, Obama didn't go every year. There are bigger COPs than other COPs. You know, I do think it would be good, frankly, if it was generally accepted. You know, the president of the United States goes every year to the NATO summit, to the G20 summit. There's these things he goes to every year. I do think it would send a good signal for a president to go to this every year. Mm-hmm. I get why not. I mean, like, as I said, we didn't. But essentially, you have all these different lines of effort. You know, you have the emissions reductions by governments that are constantly being negotiated and revised and hopefully becoming more ambitious. You have this effort to mobilize massive amounts of private sector financing for a clean energy transition around the world. You have this effort to try to generate funding. It was a Green Climate Fund. Now it's a Loss and Damages Fund. This is financing not just to help with clean energy transition, but to help deal with the effects of climate change now, which we're going to hear from some of our guests about. And oftentimes there are pledges that are not fulfilled.
Right.
And it's just one place where you get leaders, private sector, activists, you know, NGO, everybody's all together in one place. And there's a kind of accountability to it. You know, you have to show up and show your work and then try to raise the ambition.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, like the values of these COPs, summits can be hit or miss. The U.S. role can be constructive or not.
Yeah.
Trump famously pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords when he took office. Then Biden won election. He got us back into the Paris Climate Accords. The U.S. also passed the IRA, which is the largest investment in clean energy technology ever. It's worth saying, though, big picture, we're not doing enough as a planet to cut emissions to avoid catastrophic temperature increases and weather. Scientists believe that carbon emissions need to fall below 43% by 2030 to prevent the planet from warming by more than 1.5 degrees Celsius. So, again, Ben, COP28 is in Dubai. The leader of the conference is Sultan Al Jaber, who's the CEO of the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, which pumps about 4 million barrels of oil a day, and they're looking to expand to 5. You can kind of see why people are a little skeptical about this one, a little cynical.
Yeah, there's a cynicism creeping in, and I think there's a sense. I mean, look, the argument some will make for why this is okay, so I should state that as someone who's going to be cynical about it, is that ultimately you need everybody in on this deal. You have, you know, cash-rich countries like the Emiratis. If they can commit significant amounts of money or redirect significant amounts of investment to clean energy, that's a good thing. Ultimately, you got to phase out fossil fuels, so that's got to be part of the conversation. But I think the big but here is there's a greenwashing vibe, you know, to, hey, we're like, we're basically a fossil fuel cash empire, but we can have a climate change summit, and you know, that looks good, and we get to, you know, get a feather in our cap for
right.
that. And if you're, you know, the biggest thing, and you hear this from some of the activists we talked to later, like, there's a lot of frustration that yes, there are commitments around developing clean energy. Yes, there's commitments on this piece of the transition that is where we want to go, which is renewable energy sources. But there's not really this effort to end fossil fuels, you know, to phase out fossil fuels. There's some commitments to phase out subsidies for fossil fuels, and obviously there are commitments to try to shut down coal plants. But we're still pumping more oil and gas out of the ground, and unless and until we stop doing that, we're not really going to solve this problem. And so I think, you know, there's a few things that have become headwinds to climate action. One is, I think, again, this kind of sense of cynicism that fossil fuel energy is capturing this process. I think at the COP in Glasgow, I think more people went from like fossil fuel companies and from like, you know, most governments. They kind of descend on it and
lobby it.
And, you know, so that's one problem. Another is that within advanced economies, there's kind of this weird backlash against climate action. You know, I think it's because of the cost of living crisis. People are like, you know what, it's too fast, too soon. It's hurting working class in these countries. That's a problem. And then, you know, the governments themselves are not coordinating their actions in the same way. U.S. massive leadership, a massive positive step with the IRA, but it's also like a very nationalist piece of legislation. It's basically like, we're going to make all this stuff here. The supply chains have to come here. All the subsidies come here. And that's like not a coordinated approach. And that may be the only approach that can work politically. But you have China and the U.S. kind of not working together in the same way that they did before the Paris Agreement. And so there's a lot of, you know, skepticism that the COP process is, you know, losing momentum when it needs to be gaining momentum.
Yeah, and there's also just, I think, like a fundamental structural challenge, which is that climate change, even though we're feeling the effects now, is still like a long-term threat and issue, right? And there are all these near-term political challenges that pop up for leaders, and they end up tackling those first, and, you know, climate change is left behind. For example, when Russia invades Ukraine and energy prices spike, all efforts to kind of right-size the U.S. relationship with the Saudis, for example, goes out the window, and you have all these leaders from the U.K., from the U.S., others like going to Saudi Arabia, kissing the ring and trying to get them to pump more and not thinking about, okay, what can we do in the near term to maybe increase the cost of burning fossil fuels and reduce CO2 emissions?
Yeah, another example that is tied to the war in Ukraine is that there's a huge need, and I talked to John Kerry about this, for financing for Africa to develop clean energy, because, you know, Africa is going to have a huge share of the world's population in a couple of decades. And if Africa develops the same way we all did with coal and dirtier forms of energy, like we're screwed. We're not going to be able to deal with this. Right. Now, Europe, after they lost a bunch of Russian oil and gas, they started turning to Africa to like pump more gas, natural gas, you know. So like whenever you have a geopolitical crisis that creates a demand for more energy, often the first impulse is to just try to find that energy in the ground and not to, you know, turn to the renewable sources that are like have more complicated supply chains and harder to get at. So ultimately that balance is going to have to tip. But like, you know, the wars in the Middle East and Ukraine right now, both of those risk driving up oil prices, which adds incentive to pump more oil and gas out of the ground and make more money.
Now, the good news, despite all these structural challenges, is that we all have agency here, which is why we really want to talk to climate activists for the show, for this episode, especially people from the places where the impacts of climate change are being felt most acutely now. We spoke with two women from Pacific Island nations where rising sea levels and rising sea temperatures and extreme weather like cyclones are already wreaking havoc. And then, Ben, you know, the devastating thing for these island nations is that while we don't know when it will happen, climate change modeling basically tells us that by the end of this century, like life there will be untenable. And so, you know, another aspect that's important to note is in reference to COP28 and the question of responsibility from the biggest emitters is that carbon emissions combined across the entirety of these Pacific Islands amount to less than 0.03% of the world's total. So the folks who are not creating the problem are suffering the most.
Yeah.
It's just horrible.
Absolutely.
Horrible setup. So first, let's take a listen to an interview our producers conducted with Tina Yonatostigi, the climate envoy from the Marshall Islands. Here's what she had to say about the way that climate change is already affecting life for her community.
We're looking at sort of transformational changes to how we live. We likely have to consolidate populations on certain atolls. We have to build those atolls up, which means we're going to lose lands. Livelihoods will change. We know that tuna, which is a main source to our economy, it will probably migrate. We have the studies that show that it is going to migrate as seas warm and no longer be the benefit that it is now to our economy or even to, you know, what we put on the table for food. We know that if we have to leave certain places, we lose the stories associated places, we lose that link to our culture and our heritage. And certainly if we're forced to leave entirely, all of that is potentially lost. You know, our top priority is not to have to leave. Like, that's nobody wants to leave their home. And the National Adaptation Plan's guiding principle is, you know, two things. One, the right to remain, and another is self-determination. So if you had to leave, at least you have some say in where you can go and how that will look. And I think those need to continue to guide us, because basically this is going to have to be an ongoing conversation. We will need to continue to look at, you know, based on the science, but also on traditional knowledge and people's family ties, where what makes the most sense in terms of if an entire community has to leave their island, which is the place that they have to go? And how do we then decide where we can consolidate sort of services to best provide what people need?
So as we were saying earlier, you know, it's easy to feel cynical about the non-binding pledges made at COP and how much sometimes domestic politics prevents a lack of follow through. But here's why Tina said she feels like it's important for her to attend.
While the process is flawed, and while it hasn't delivered the change that we actually need to respond to climate change, so it's incremental versus transformative, which is what we need, the COP is a place where we, as Marshall Islands, get to sit next to countries that are far larger, with far more resources, and have a voice and be at the table, right? So I can sit next to Secretary Kerry from the United States and, you know, explain why adaptation for the Marshall Islands is an existential issue. While it might not be for the United States, we need to be able to reaffirm that, particularly on climate, you know, we can't go it alone. No one can.
And then, Ben, you spoke with Elizabeth Keaty, a climate activist from Tonga, right?
Yeah, and, you know, Elizabeth builds on what we just heard, representing a different island perspective as well. That really gets at, I think, both the stakes of what she's facing and the people of Tonga and Pacific Islands are facing, but also the role that, you know, younger activists like her play at COP.
We are already seeing in the capital of Tonga, Nuku'alofa, our government offices moving inland. And this is because this whole area, which is right by the ocean, will be underwater in the next 50 or so years. I think as well, a really good example is to talk about Tuvalu, what's recently happened with their deal with Australia. Australia, because of how fast Tuvalu is going underwater, Australia struck a deal with them to give them land and permanent residency. So Tuvalu is leading the way in this. And Tonga, I hope our government's already looking into seeing what we can do for our people. I know my family, we already are looking into, you know, what country do we move to? Is it Australia? Is it New Zealand? Do we go as far out as America? We need to start now for our future. My mom has her first grandson, and it's going to affect his life. I believe my grandchildren won't even know what Tonga is, and that's very sad. But this is the reality that not just my family are facing, but our whole country and our entire region, all due to the superpowers of this world who are responsible for the crisis that we are facing. What would you do if someone, actually, if a group of very powerful people came to your home and started damaging your home and putting your family's life at risk? I think you would do anything in your power to fight those people away. This isn't a thing that I chose to do. It's what I have to do. It's my duty to my country and my people. And unfortunately, it's a duty of every Tongan. It's what we are facing. We have no choice but to fight.
So as we mentioned at the top, you know, it's not ideal that this COP is in the UAE, an oil-rich country, and it's not ideal that the president of COP28 is literally the CEO of an oil company. And then, you know, you sort of alluded to this earlier, Ben, but last year's COP there were close to 400 people in attendance that were in some way connected to the fossil fuel industries. So that's a little gross. It can make you feel outgunned as an activist. But we spoke with Emily Atkin, a climate journalist who writes the newsletter Heated, to explain to us sort of what the impact is of having all those fossil fuel interests there.
You don't just send delegates from country governments to these COPs. You send people are allowed to go who have an interest in the process. And so delegates from fossil fuel companies, hundreds have been present at each COP, influencing the process, influencing what comes out at the very end. And this year is not only no different, but almost way worse, because the big game, quote unquote, game-changing new development that is going to happen because Sultan Al-Jaber, the head of ADNOC, is going to be in charge of it. He's like, my game-changing idea is that we're going to have more influence from oil and gas companies at this COP this time. And we're all going to be really focused on solving climate change this time. It's almost like having a guy who's been really crappy to you for decades be in charge of the conference about how to treat you better. Because you're just like, well, I guess he could. He knows me really well, right? Like, he could treat me better. And I guess I could ignore the last 30 years of how he has treated me, but I really don't know if that's, like, something I want to do.
That doesn't sound like the best setup.
Not the best relationship, yeah.
No.
I mean, look, I think what you can take away from that is, first of all, the stakes, you know, are existential. And we hear from the island activists and negotiator that, you know, their lives are already changing to the point that they're literally planning to have to maybe leave their homelands en masse. Just the mass displacement of indigenous populations and people because of the way in which superpowers and, you know, the rest of us have developed over the last, you know, particularly 150 years. But that should be a warning, because that's coming for, like, the rest of us, too.
Yeah. Hey, Miami.
Yeah, exactly. It's easy to be like, oh, that's terrible, but that's some distant island.
Right.
No, like, this, that just shows that, like, the nature is not going to, like, be kind, you know, to some people, not others. Like, there's going to be, there already are massive climate effects that are hurting innocent people who didn't create the problem, but it's coming for everybody, and it already is. And then I think what you hear in that, you know, in terms of the cynicism of the fossil fuel industry, is that this is what needs to be overcome. Like, this is the barrier to truly treating this like the emergency that it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's a lot of investment happening, a lot of actions happening. There are things that are happening that are worthwhile that could limit this damage and mitigate this damage, or at least create funding mechanisms to help those people in the Pacific Islands either, you know, limit the effect of climate change or tragically relocate. But ultimately, if you're not breaking through the fossil fuel wall here to the other side of climate action, you know, there's just only so much we can do.
Yeah, and we asked Emily to elaborate a little more on the fossil fuel industries. How their presence impacts the efficacy of these COP summits.
The argument from UAE and from a lot of nations that have deep ties to oil companies is that we need those people at the table because they are the ones who are going to be most affected by these policies to slow climate change, because climate change is caused primarily by fossil fuels, right? So we need the people who are at the head of these corporations to be involved. The problem is that every single time oil and gas corporations have been involved is that we have come out with a watered-down agreement. This happened last year, right at the end of COP27. Countries were approaching an agreement to phase down fossil fuels. The agreement was written right at the end of COP27. That was taken out. It was because of the opposition of nations like China, Russia, Egypt, oil-producing nations. We don't know exactly what the influence of oil and gas corporations were. We can't know, because so many of those negotiations happened behind closed doors. What we know is that there were more delegates from the fossil fuel industry last year than there were from any country except for two.
So one small reform at COP28 is, for the first time, fossil fuel lobbyists who attend will actually have to identify themselves as fossil fuel lobbyists when they register for the event. That seems like it should have been the case since the first COP, but it wasn't a requirement. So now we'll actually know for sure exactly how many fossil fuel lobbyists are there.
Yeah.
Progress, transparency.
Good to know that. I mean, you'd like to think by COP 20, whatever this is, that we would be a little further along. But I mean, you know, to use a dad expression, you know, this is a bit like asking the fox to be in charge of security at the hen house here, you know, yes. to put these people in charge of hosting the summit. And, you know,
we should cover them. If you're a fossil lawyer, you should get covered with oil.
Yeah.
You just walk around like that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you could that's have my a future pitch. As a climate activist.
Thank you. That's my pitch. Yeah. They're like,
give us some ideas. You know,
throw soup on a Monet or something like that.
Yeah. And that's actually better than throwing soup on a Monet.
Yeah. Don't actually do that. Anyone listening? Emily did sort of want to warn us, though, that sometimes press releases come out from these events or joint statements, and they can sound hopeful and impressive, but there's some weasel words in there that you got to keep an eye out for. And one thing she told us to look out for this year was the phrase unabated fossil fuels.
I think that this year we're going to see a really big push from UAE, from oil producing nations, from even the US to make this big claim. This is the year that they are all going to make a commitment to phase out fossil fuels, but they're going to use this word unabated before it. The word unabated fossil fuels means a fossil fuel whose emission doesn't have a plan eventually to be captured by carbon capture technology. That means nothing, right? There's no technical definition for what that means. That could mean we have a plan in 40 years to capture the carbon that was once released by this oil refinery, right? That's what it could mean. So watch out for the word unabated, because you can already see it sort of happening in the news that countries are saying, we are good with a plan to phase out unabated fossil fuels. And that does not really mean anything unless there is a definition of it that says it means the emissions have to be captured right away and 100% of them.
I think this is the first time I've heard the word unabated, and I already hate it.
So I was going to say, you know, I have like a bit of a hobby horse about like the language of foreign policy and diplo-speak. And one general rule of thumb is if there is a word that is like central to the phraseology that you have either never heard or would literally never use in a conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm never like, how was your day? Like, it was pretty good until I had that unabated sandwich, you know, for lunch or something. You know, it's a pretty good, it's like a put your bullshit meter up, you know.
Big time.
And I do, there are all these ways to kind of create wiggle room around not doing the thing you're supposed to be doing, and usually it's like some legalese that doesn't.
Yeah, there's a lot of the sort of gist of it is there's a lot of conversations about carbon capture down the road and getting carbon out of the air, which is great and something we'll need to do, but that doesn't mean we don't have to reduce the amount of fossil fuels we're burning in the short term. That's critical.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of these formulations. They're still worthwhile doing these things. Carbon capture, like you said, is important. You know, carbon offsets that people do are important. Technology is important to figuring out carbon capture. These are not insignificant things. I think that the basic issue, though, that needs to be confronted is the disconnect between the urgency and these types of approaches that kind of envision like a runway of time that we don't have anymore. You know?
Yes, exactly.
I mean, there was actually, like, we've gotten in the bad habit of, like, referencing The Daily on this podcast, but it is occasionally very good.
Great show.
They had a good show recently on the EV push in this country and the challenge of getting people to buy EVs.
That was a great episode.
And, you know, I think the most, you know, I think the thing that really stuck with me in that conversation was that, you know, like, about 1 million EVs were sold this or projected to sell this year, which is a lot, but it's nowhere near. It's like a fraction of non-EV cars. And the problem with that is not that, you know, sure, that's going to go up each year and that's great. The problem with that is that every car that's going on the road now that is not an EV is likely still going to be on the road in like 10 years, mm-hmm. you know? And it's the same thing with developing new, you know, fossil fuels and, you know, permits for new drilling. And once you start doing that, there's like a life cycle to this. And so what they're doing with this unabated thing is saying, sure, we're doing all this new drilling. We're creating all this new emissions. But we're going to promise you that we're going to figure out a way to offset that. And oftentimes, it's not even like a concrete promise. It's kind of like we're committing.
We're to plant a bunch of trees.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to commit to deploy new technologies. We're commit to plant a bunch of trees. We commit to these kinds of offsets, and that's good. That's much better than where we were 10 or 20 years ago. But that progress isn't happening fast enough, given where the climate already is.
Yeah, I'm Tommy Vitor, and this is Pod Save the World. Do you think that whenever Barbaro does the very smart thing in radio where someone says something to you and you summarize and repeat it, do you ever think the journalists are ever like, yeah, man, I just fucking said that?
Well, there's this thing.
What if I just repeated back to you everything
the journalist,
you said?
There's two things that that now that we plugged the Daily, there are two things that I'm going to say that are irksome, or humorous at least. One is that he does that thing, and the journalist is always like, that's exactly right.
Goddamn,
you know,
right.
Like, goddamn right, Barbaro. You just summed it up.
But he's being an advocate for the listener who, you know, sometimes you want something summarized.
But the other interesting thing is, like, Sabrina Tavernisi,
who's
a great journalist. And, I mean, I have a huge respect for her.
Don't you knock Sabrina in my presence.
Well, I'm just going to.
Don't you do it.
Somehow she sounds more and more like Michael Barbaro.
Like, someone's telling them to talk like that.
Sometimes I'll like, turn it on, and it'll take me, like, a minute to be like, oh, wait, that's Sabrina. Because she's developed the, like,
this
low throat.
This is the Daily.
The Daily.
Just talk normal.
Yeah.
It's cool to talk normal.
Yeah.
Before we take a break, we are so excited to announce a new show. It's called Inside 2024. It's our new monthly podcast series available exclusively to the Friends of the Pod subscribers. It is a fun show. It is a chance to hear from, you know, White House alumni, talk about what really goes on behind the scenes of a presidential campaign, everything from debate prep to convention speeches to campaign ads to botched media appearances to election day. To get access to Inside 2024, join our community over at Friends of the Pod by signing up at crooked.com/friends. Also, everyone loves a good Black Friday sale, but charging through a mall parking lot with a stomach full of pie just doesn't hit like it used to. Shop the Crooked Store's Black Friday deals from the comfort of your couch. Everything is 20% off, plus you can look out for surprise flash sales all week long. Go to crooked.com/store to shop and make sure you're signed up for the email list to find out the moment each flash sale starts. Okay, with that, we're going to take a quick break. Pod Save the World is brought to you by Outer Known. It is no secret that our choices have a huge impact on the environment. So a brand that doesn't only look great, but is also environmentally friendly is the perfect way to go. Outer Known was founded by legendary professional surfer Kelly Slater. He founded the brand to make high-quality clothing that doesn't negatively impact the planet or the people that are working to bring it to you in your closet. So when you wear Outer Known, you're not just wearing a piece of clothing, you're wearing a product for a better planet. Outer Known makes men's and women's clothes that are organic and made from recycled materials using fair trade factories all over the world. They're comfy, they're cozy, they fit great, and they're designed to last. They also make tees, denim pants, swim trunks, sweaters, and everything else you could want, all made with the highest regard for sustainability and the planet. I got tons of Outer Known stuff. I have really comfortable, good-looking sweaters that everybody loves.
We all love sweaters.
We got great t-shirts. I bought kind of almost a shacket style sort of overshirt the other day. It's really comfortable, good-looking, and just cozy for this time of year.
Or a jirt.
Go to outerknown.com/PSW. And if you go today, you'll get 25% off your first order. That's a lot off. That's outerknown.com/PSW, outerknown.com/PSW to receive the 25% discount code. Check them out today, outerknown.com/PSW, and don't forget to use the promo code on the page for 25% off. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Guys, we're getting to that end of the year. The sun goes down early. Can feel
it's a real bummer.
Gloomy. Maybe you struggle with the seasonal blues. This time of year, it could be a lot. It's natural to feel some sadness or anxiety about it, but adding something new and positive to your life can counteract those feelings. Therapy can be a bright spot amid all the stress and change, something to look forward to make you feel grounded and give you the tools to manage everything that's going on. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Look, if you're listening to this show, odds are you need therapy.
Mm.
I know my listeners. I know my audience. I know what you need. Check out BetterHelp.
Tommy knows what you need.
Find your bright spot this season with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/CrookedWorld. Go today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/CrookedWorld. Posse of the World is brought to you by Tommy John. There are exactly two kinds of gifts in the world, ooze and O's.
What about end of gab?
Want guaranteed ooze? Be bold. Give the gift of Tommy John underwear.
Ooh, underwear.
When you give Tommy John, your loved ones are that much more comfortable so they can do everything better.
I'm wearing Tommy John right now.
Especially certain things.
Ew.
This Black Friday, like wow, going for a jog. This Black Friday, why not give the gift of comfort to everyone on your list, including yourself, with the new Tommy John underwear, loungewear, and pajamas with over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews. Given Tommy John is a holiday tradition, 97% of women and men love getting the gift of Tommy John. That's why Tommy John doesn't have customers. They have fanatics.
Fanatics.
They're all fanatics. Related to that Philly fanatic guy. One Tommy John fanatic raves, fantastic Christmas gift that went so right, she loves the pajamas. I love my Tommy John. I got all the underwear. I got the PJ pants. They're super PJ comfortable. Pants. They're great. Shop Tommy John's amazing Black Friday sale. It's going on right now. Save 30% site-wide at TommyJohn.com/world. 30% off everything for a limited time at TommyJohn.com/world. See site for details. Posse of the World is brought to you by Kariuma. Kariumas have been our go-to sneakers for a while now because they are so comfortable. They go with everything, and they are made with consciously sourced materials. We love – actually, I'm wearing Kariumas right now, guys.
Look at them.
Check them out.
Whoa. Look at them. What color Look is that? Look at them. I'd say it's a taupe.
Taupe. Audacity of taupe. Last year, we collaborated with Kariuma to create a no-step-back sneakers, and we can't believe that they have now designed a second limited edition collaboration with us, the Love It or Leave It sneaker.
And they're great.
These shoes.
Really cool design.
Got it all.
And they're selling out.
Colorful design. There's Easter eggs.
They are.
They're not Taylor Swift-level Easter eggs. No Travis Kelce on those things.
I got to tell you something. Travis Kelce's putting out music, and you know what? It's good.
Really?
It's good?
I like the song. I like the song.
It's not like a rock rap.
No, no, no. It's that Pogue song, Fairy Tale for New York, Fairy Tale. It's a Christmas song, but it's one of those great songs that's like almost like the worse the singer, the better it is because it feels like homey, you know? Okay. It's good.
Okay.
I'm just saying.
Speaking of things that are good, Pundit on a Surfboard.
Pundit on a Surfboard.
Plus a portion of the proceeds from every pair sold is donated to Vote Save America's Every Last Vote Fund. So you're looking good and doing good. Our first Kariuma collab sold out extremely fast. So if you want a pair for yourself or the Love It or Leave It fan in your life, make sure to snag one now. They will make the perfect gift for the holiday season, but they won't last forever, folks. Go to crooked.com/store. That's crooked.com/store. So it shouldn't be a mystery to anyone who listens to the show why climate change is a problem and why we need to address it. But to your point, Ben, I mean, the science keeps getting worse. It's not getting better.
Right?
I read a big report about, like, you know, ice sheets melting.
It's never like, emissions. Oh, we got a great report from the climate scientists today. No. Like,
we are in big trouble. So we went to an expert, Alyssa Acco. She's the senior climate scientist and Barbara Streisand chair of environmental studies at the Environmental Defense Fund.
Yeah.
Ben, one of the things you might have noticed is that these goddamn scientists keep shifting the goalposts on us. They used to always talk about not letting global temperatures rise by 2 degrees Celsius. These days, they're saying we can't let it rise by 1.5 degrees Celsius. So we asked Dr. Acco to explain why.
The reason for these long-term average temperature goals, like 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2 degrees Celsius, is because large-scale changes in the climate system that could dramatically change life as we know it. I mean, we're talking about landscapes changing from grasslands to deserts and losing parts of the rainforest and ocean circulation patterns changing so that less heat is carried to Europe to keep it at the moderate temperatures that it's at, even though it has a really high latitude. You know, though all of those changes respond to changes in the long-term temperature. So 2 degrees Celsius used to be the main target, in part because that was considered the temperature increase in which modern human civilization has never experienced before. Once we breached that level, it was like this unknown territory outside of our comfort zone, and that alone was scary. But now scientists have done a lot of research on what the climate consequences are of a 2 degrees Celsius temperature rise and a 1.5 degrees Celsius rise. And what researchers have found is that a half a degree of warming makes an enormous difference in terms of people at risk from things like sea level rise, poverty, water stress, severe heat, and many other impacts. And so because of all of the additional consequences from going from 1.5 to 2C, the new global target became 1.5 Celsius because we could save that many more lives if we're able to achieve it.
She also cautioned, though, that we shouldn't just frame